Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about something which is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. It is constant. It is stress. And we're going to talk to the author of a book that explains in detail what stress does to us and how to overcome the effects of stress. It's called The Stress Remedy. She is very well known. She has completed her studies in naturopathic medicine, and she participates in three clinics here in the tri-state region, in New York City, on Long Island, and in Stamford, Connecticut. She is known to her patients and people who follow her in Huffington Post and in blogs as simply Dr. Donnie Wilson. And so welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, Dr. Donnie. It's nice having you here.
Thank you so much.
So tell us a little bit about your background. You actually came to examine the effects of stress because you yourself were stressed because you took a highly unusual educational pathway. You actually are dually certified as a naturopath, but also as a midwife. That sounds like a lot of stress to take on both simultaneously.
It was. And, you know, there's something about me that I'm drawn to want to multitask, like many of us, but it does come with stress. And so I think I became interested in it, in stress from a personal perspective as well as from watching others who were under stress.
But I think your clients can come to appreciate that you are someone who's, you have life in the fast lane, and yet you seem to have come up with a strategy involving various practices, diet, certain supplements, certain lifestyle practices that help you cope with stress, and that's what you do on a daily basis when people consult with you.
Yeah, from a young age, actually, I really became interested in how we eat and what we eat affects our health. I grew up in a house where my father was a pharmacist and also running pharmacy chain. And so people sometimes would think that since I was so exposed to pharmaceuticals, that would be my main interest. And actually, it turned out that living in the house with a pharmacist, you end up wanting to prevent the use of pharmaceuticals, and so I became very interested in how to maintain health through diet and nutrition and exercise. So, you know, that really led me to want to study naturopathic medicine as well as midwifery.
And I bet that many of the clients who come to see you, they may be medical professionals themselves, doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants, and pharmacists, or people who work for pharmaceutical companies, and yet they turn to a more naturopathic approach for solutions.
It's true. I think, you know, to some degree, right, it's when you see some of these chronic conditions in your work and you start to realize, boy, what can I do to prevent this?
Oh, absolutely. So give us which you outline in your book very nicely, The Stress Remedy. Give us an introduction to what stress is and the physiology of stress. What is it actually doing in our bodies?
I would say one of the most important things to know, to understand stress, is to know the hormone called cortisol. And that's really our stress hormone made by the adrenal glands, which are near the kidneys. And cortisol, of course, we need it. We don't want to eliminate it. It creates our circadian rhythm, and it does some good things in our body as well. But when we're under stress, either a crisis or just a short-term stress, or if it's being under even mild stress day after day, our cortisol levels are going to respond and adapt. Our bodies are really meant to and built to help us adapt to stress. But when we adapt to stress, it means that our cortisol levels will either go a little too high or too low.
And it's so it can go either way. And that's what I see in many of the patients who I test for cortisol. I see there's an abnormality, but it could be too high or it could be too low. In fact, these days, because of the stress inherent in our modern lifestyles, especially, you know, for my patients in Manhattan, and you treat some of those patients yourself, it's the rare patient who has normal cortisol.
It is, and I think it's because we're constantly adapting to stress. In my what I did is I researched 127 adults, and I share this in the book, The Stress Remedy, because I was really curious. I really wanted to know, can we anticipate that either based on symptoms or circumstances that a person has either high or low cortisol? And what the research showed is that we can't guess. You really can't guess even based on symptoms. The only way to know what's happening with your cortisol is to do a test for it, like you were mentioning.
Right. I guess one way that I look at it is that the vast majority of my patients are either burnt out or on their way to burnout. They actually may be flaming out before they burn out. It's sort of like, someone with a thyroid problem. So at first it goes high and you get hyperthyroidism, but the aftermath is that you crash and you have hypothyroidism. The same thing happens with the adrenals, apparently.
Yes, this is another thing from the research study that I did I was really interested in, is what is that path? And what I found is that it's very individual. I mean, it's not based on age, for example. We might think, someone who's older and has experienced more stress is more likely to be in burnout. But it's not necessarily the case. You can see someone who's, 8 years old and has low cortisol. The way I think about it now is I think about it as a person's fingerprint. Each person has a very individual cortisol response to stress. And one person's cortisol may go quickly to a low level, where another person may stay a long time at a high level. And so, while we do think of it as something that can progress over time, it really is individualized.
Well, and to some extent it's genetic, because we know, for example, that looking at rabbits as a species, there are white rabbits, those cute, little bit lethargic, pink-eyed white rabbits that are fun to have as pets. But we know they're very fragile. They get a little stressed or they get a little sick, they die right away. It's like, it's like your kid's crying because their rabbit, they go to the cage, the rabbit's lying there motionless. But the wild rabbits, they undergo all kinds of stress and survive. They seem to have, perhaps it's because they have stronger adrenals.
Yes, it's very much genetic. It also, and this brings us back to midwifery to some degree, it depends on the health of the parent, even before pregnancy, then during pregnancy, and then a person's exposure to stress in early childhood. All of these things create a person's fingerprint of their stress response throughout their life.
Well, that's interesting. So how can childhood experiences or experiences in infant or maybe experiences in utero shape the adrenal response of the individual later in life?
And some people, I think, can relate. And I think to some degree it even determines whether a person is drawn to stressful experiences in their life. So we started off talking about how
like addiction to stress, like people are sort of like hooked on stress, and when they're not stressed, they're pulling their hair out. They don't know what to do with themselves.
Yes, just like I tend to be a person who I like to multitask. I chose to do 2 degrees at once. Mm-hmm. Very likely that came from, something about my early life and genetics that kind of set me up for that. And once a person knows themselves, and this is what I really encourage in the book, is to know yourself. Understand not only your physiology, that like you and I are talking about, we know the human physiology of cortisol, where cortisol is, we want it to be high in the morning and gradually down through the day. We know cortisol is going to spike with an acute stress. Those things are just part of human physiology. Then when a person understands their own body and how it responds to stress individually, then they can make choices for them that's going to benefit their health. And that's why it's not about one answer for every person. It's about understanding what is your optimal stress. Because even some stress is good, right?
Yes.
It's not that we're trying to eliminate it. We just have to learn what stress is best for our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the concept of eustress, EU-stress,
yeah.
And then there's the concept of something they call in medicine hormesis, which is a little bit of something that is maybe stressful or toxic, actually may cause the body to rally and prompt a proper defensive reaction by the body.
Exactly. So like when a woman is in labor, what we know is that you have to have a certain amount of a stress response, a good amount of cortisol and catecholamine response or adrenaline response. And that's what creates a progressive labor. It's when there's too much stress or actually too little stress that labor doesn't progress. And I think that's a really good physiological example of how our bodies need stress, but it needs to be an amount of stress that creates a positive response.
Right. So, okay, so let's assume, you know, someone has a predisposition to involve themselves, to overcommit, to work really hard, to push, even on the exercise front, to really hammer. That's something you can do for a while, but what happens when, you know, you go a little past your limitations?
Exactly. Then oftentimes with that, what you're describing would be an elevated cortisol. And this is the thing from the research that I really found, that if we pull the information together, it starts to make sense. It starts to connect the dots, which is cortisol affects four major systems in the body. One is the digestive system. A lot of people can relate to that, right? Because if you're stressed, a lot of times people will get an upset stomach, or the classic would be an ulcer, right? A gastric ulcer. So we know cortisol, okay, is going to affect the digestion, but it also affects the immune system. So that can mean more susceptibility to infections, autoimmunity, cancer, all along the line of the immune system. Cortisol also affects the endocrine system, all the hormones in the body, right? We know if cortisol is high, then insulin function decreases. So we see this, this is why a lot of female athletes end up with amenorrhea, because high cortisol is going to inhibit ovarian function. Mm-hmm. So you see this effect on the endocrine system. And the fourth area is the neurotransmitters. So to see that cortisol is now affecting the nervous system really opens up a whole world of options and opportunities to support patients with mental health issues by looking at cortisol.
Right. Well, so just like with taking oral steroids, we have a model in medicine where cortisol is what the body makes, and then a synthetic form of cortisol is cortisone, hydrocortisone, or prednisone, even stronger, or Decadron, methylprednisolone. You know, many of these drugs are mimicking the body's own cortisol. And what happens that's deleterious when you rely on these medications too much?
Well, then you're going to be suppressing the adrenal function, and you may actually create an elevated cortisol level with the medications and end up affecting these four systems in a negative way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, causing cataracts, skeletal problems, mental problems, you know, many, many difficulties arise from excess outside cortisol, the medications, and also internal overproduction, right?
And it's a good example because it helps us to see, we can see what happens when a person's on a prescription cortisone for too long, and that's what we then see as parallel when a person has elevated cortisol due to stress for too long.
Well, Dr. Donny, also, one of the most common problems that we see in our practices, as you know, is people say, I can't lose weight. I swear to you, I'm really on a good diet. I exercise like crazy. I don't know what it is. I can't shed those extra pounds. Could cortisol be a problem that keeps the pounds on?
Absolutely. And I bring it back to those four systems again. As I was mentioning, when your cortisol is high, the insulin function is going to drop. So that one immediately is going to make it harder to lose weight or easier to gain weight, right, if the insulin function is decreased.
Yeah.
But also now we're learning this connection between the digestive tract and weight gain. So if cortisol is affecting digestion, disrupting the intestinal lining and the balance of healthy bacteria in the intestines.
It actually has come out that your mental stress can affect the bacteria in your intestine. It can alter the composition of bacteria in your intestine, which changes your metabolism. That's incredible.
Right, and that is such a that circle. We weren't connecting those dots before. But if we connect stress with digestion and those healthy bacteria going off track and that affecting your insulin function, weight gain right there, who would have thought?
Yeah, it's an amazing concept because it sort of permeates our health, you know, the health of our adrenals. So this is on the excess adrenal front, and obviously people are going to ask us for solutions, so we'll circle back in just a minute. Conversely, sometimes we check patients. By the way, how do we check adrenal function? I think that's an important question.
Well, you know, it can be checked in the blood, but then you get this one, you know, get a level at the time the blood was drawn. So I encourage doing salivary samples at least 4 times of a day so that we can see the pattern. We really want to see what is cortisol morning, noon, evening, bedtime. And if a person's waking in the night, sometimes we'll even do a cortisol when they're waking so we can see if that's part of the waking issue.
Mm-hmm. Because at night, your cortisol should really settle down as part of the sleep process.
Yes.
Indeed. Okay. So that basically, you give the patient a kit. They spit into these test tubes. It's a mailer. They send it back, prepaid postage, and then you get the practitioner will get a report and a curve. And the curve should normally show what?
It should show, higher in the morning. You don't want it too high either, but you want it higher in the morning and gradually down through the day so that it's lowest at night. And really, it's usually considered 6 a.m. is the time when cortisol should be the highest. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of wake us up in the morning.
Right. And, you know, I have to say that there's a real correspondence between very high morning cortisol and depression and anxiety. And, in fact, I think there was a recent study looking at adolescent boys saying that if there's no blood test for depression, there's no other than the psychiatrist's opinion as to whether you have depression. But the closest thing that comes to a test is measuring your morning cortisol. If it's sky high, that may be an indication that you're suffering from depression. Call it what you want.
Oh, I really think it's important to check cortisol with mood disorders because depression is also found with not just high but also low cortisol.
Right.
And so you really need to be looking for that.
So conversely, let's say a patient does this saliva test, and instead of getting a moderate level in the morning and then a gentle curve downward through the day, you'd get like a flat line. You know, it's like this is really low levels of cortisol production. How might that patient present to your office?
Well, and one good point, especially for practitioners, is that I suppose every so often we might find someone with, say, Addison's disease on a panel like
yes.
this, but we're looking at people who don't have Addison's or Cushing's disease. We're looking at people who are somewhere in the middle
right.
between that, just a maladapted cortisol level. And so if their cortisol level is low, it says that their adrenals are not having that healthy response.
Right. So we're looking at what are called subclinical conditions because, as you know, and I know very well, some patients will say, hey, you know, I went to Dr. Hoffman, or they may say, I went to Dr. Donnie. They said I had low adrenals. They go to an endocrinologist, and the endocrinologist will test them and say, you're perfectly normal. You don't have Addison's disease, and you don't have Cushing's disease, so you're normal. We recognize states of less than optimal, shall we say, subclinical problems with distortion of the normal pattern that cause people symptoms short of a full-blown disease.
Yes, and I think that's an important distinction. And it's also just such a powerful preventive measure, you know, to be able to find tools that help us when someone might be feeling tired or low mood, but they don't have maybe a diagnosable condition. But here's something that shows us what's going on in the function of the body that could be improved. And as you're mentioning in a situation here, say if the cortisol levels are low, to me, the first thing I'm thinking is maybe if we help them with dietary changes, lifestyle changes, even certain nutrients and herbs, we can get oftentimes the adrenal glands to improve their function again. It doesn't mean to me that their adrenals are done forever. It means these adrenal glands need support and recovery and can recover and come back to a healthy curve on their own.
So,
anytime.
Right. So perhaps, between you and me, I find that the low adrenal state is more amenable to correction than the high adrenal state, although they're treatments for both. So why don't we start with the low-hanging fruit, the low adrenal person, the person with suboptimal adrenals, and they might feel tired. What else? What would be a tip-off that suggests they might have it, and then the test would corroborate that?
You know, in the research study that I did, fatigue is the most likely symptom with a low cortisol level. So, yes, the fatigue, I would say, is the most common, although there could also be low mood, and potentially feeling cold, feeling dizzy, headaches. Even sometimes you'll have symptoms like anxiety or sleep issues and weight gain. So there can be a lot of potential symptoms there.
And usually accompanied by, to me, a tip-off is low blood pressure generally in the low adrenal patients, right? And probably lower sex drive, loss of libido, and so on. So weak and woozy, I sometimes describe it as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, that's a good way to remember it. You know, it's just feeling like weak and woozy and nothing else to explain it. You know, this person may also have, for example, anemia or low thyroid. It's not to say that those things may be coming along with it, but it's important, I find, to address the low adrenal function in order to help with resolution of other issues.
Okay, so we often talk about adrenal support. I think that's a familiar term to many of our listeners. And, of course, conventional medicine would say, look, if you have low adrenal function, you've got to give hydrocortisone, which is something that I do with my patients when it's very low. I actually give them that from time to time. But I prefer not to because, you know, there's side effects. It's a little bit of a, you know, harsh treatment. I like to see usually if they can reawaken their adrenals. So what are some of the strategies you use in your practice?
Well, one of the most important things is getting to, you know, back to good sleep. You would think when a person's cortisol is low that they, you know, that they would be very sleepy and sleeping a lot. But actually, a lot of those people have sleep issues. And so resolving the sleep issue and helping them to get a good 7.5 to 9 hours of sleep every night, it's amazing how much the adrenals recover just with some sleep.
So is it lifestyle modification, helping them with sleep hygiene, allocating enough time, you know, all the right things to that are conducive to sleep?
Yes. So we cover that. And then, you know, what I also do is in terms of diet, I come back to wanting to help balance blood sugar levels, because this is another thing that can really be a stress to the adrenals that we can do something about, which is making sure that we feed ourselves something with protein every couple hours, or I usually say 3 to 4 hours throughout the day. When people are going long hours without eating or having, you know, a large meal with carbohydrates, that's only going to throw the cortisol more and deplete the adrenals more. So one thing that I always encourage patients with low adrenal function is to just make sure they're getting small meals with protein frequently through the day.
Indeed. And of course, you know, if we look at physiology, insulin pushes down on blood sugar, and cortisol helps to counteract that, raising blood sugar. So a patient having low adrenal function, they often have terrible hypoglycemic symptoms. Yes. They just a few hours after eating, they just feel terribly hungry, or they feel completely knocked out, and they feel like they constantly have to put on the feed bag. Often making a mistake, often having sugary foods and stimulant foods to kind of, you know, reboot their adrenals, but that's like whipping a dead horse.
Or drinking a lot of coffee because they're so tired and they're just, you know, so sugar and coffee, you're right, it's something, it's a person with low adrenals is going to be tempted to go that direction, but helping them to correct that and eat this other way that's going to be much more supportive to help keep those blood sugar levels balanced, it's going to help the adrenals recover.
Right. So stimulants are definitely not the way to go. And this is a culture that relies on stimulants. Look at all the Starbucks. Look at the Red Bull Monster drink, you know, all those things that, you know, I feel sorry for some of the kids who are whipping their adrenals into complete dysfunction. In a few years, they may end up on our doorsteps.
Yes, exactly. It's tempting and it's a quick fix. But when you start to understand that it's, you know, our bodies are constantly adapting, it's at some point that it's the body's not going to be able to manage that anymore, and the person's going to really feel horrible.
So it sounds like a lot of what you do with patients is you give them a picture and you explain it, you explain their physiology, and it helps them adjust their lifestyle accordingly.
Yes, it really makes a difference, I find, when people understand. Then they're more likely to make choices, not just because I'm saying so, but because they can understand it and they can feel the difference in their body, right? And then it's much more likely to be something they can do ongoing.
Indeed. So, okay, so what? Obviously, as a naturopath, you are armed with a whole armamentarium of natural remedies that support adrenal function. So what are some of your favorites?
You know, I always like to start by thinking of, you know, nutrients. I mean, even if it's a really good multivitamin or B vitamin, the B vitamins and vitamin C, we know are important nutrients for adrenal function. So if it's not a multivitamin, then it may be a formula that has B vitamins, pantothenic acid, and vitamin C in it to support the adrenals. Mm-hmm. And then in the herb family, there's what we call adaptogenic herbs, which are, if you don't know whether the cortisol is high or low, adaptogenic herbs are a nice place to start because they help to bring the cortisol back to optimal, whether it's too high or too low.
That being the idea of an adaptogen. An adaptogen sort of brings things into homeostasis. If they're too high, it helps, and if it's too low, it helps as well. It seems paradoxical in Western medicine, but that's the way adaptogens work, like ginseng, but there are many others, right?
Amazing, right, that you can use one plant and have it, you don't know what needs to be done. It's pretty cool. Yes, from licorice, Eleutherococcus, and...
That's a Siberian ginseng, right?
Siberian ginseng is Eleutherococcus. And then there's rhodiola and ashwagandha and holy basil. And there's quite a few, schisandra. So you'll see formulas with these kinds of herbs in there that are going to be general adaptogens. But what I prefer, what I find when patients are really struggling with either too high or too low cortisol levels, and maybe an adaptogen only is getting them a little ways, then doing the testing and finding out exactly what their cortisol levels are, because then we can use herbs that are more specific for either trying to lower cortisol or raise cortisol.
Now, okay, so in the instance of high cortisol, say someone has sky-high cortisol, what are some of the things that tend to bring... I mean, obviously that's a lot about lifestyle. I mean, you can't just say, look, give me a pill to make my cortisol go down. You really got to talk to your patient about their whole way of being and, you know, yeah, have them, you know, chill out and relax and, you know, sleep better and, you know, take some time to allow their physiology to normalize, because they can't do that by staying in the fast lane. But,
one of the most common scenarios is that the cortisol just stays too high at night. So if a person, you know, you get home from work and your mind is still going,
can't
you
settle
know
down.
Your cortisol's probably, your body didn't get the memo that it was the end of the workday.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I occasionally have nights like that, and it's hard to shut things off. You get over-exuberant.
Oh, yeah. So then, you know, it definitely helps to just go through rituals that tell us, you know, turn off the computer and, you know, turn down the lights and, you know, really start to give your body the message that it's time to relax and recover, which is, we know from the research, is so important for all of our cells to have that recovery time. There are nutrients that can also help that have been shown in research to help. I mean, one that comes to mind is phosphatidylserine. Mm-hmm. Has been shown to help get the cortisol levels back on track. In terms of herbs, there's herbs like magnolia, and then one that I've used more recently is called banaba leaf, which I've seen to be pretty effective at helping to bring cortisol levels back down. But again, you're right, Dr. Hoffman, in that, you know, it's one thing to take the herb, but the person really still does need to make sure that they're managing their lifestyle and their diet and in order to help keep those levels where you want them.
Right. And in terms of exercise prescription, put on the exercise gear, hitting a treadmill, getting out there and pumping iron is beneficial. But what about for someone who has serious adrenal problems?
Then I think, yes, you just really have to be careful. If the cortisol levels are low, then often that person, you know, if they end up going to exercise, they're going to feel exhausted for days.
And that's a tip-off. That's actually one of the tip-offs for low adrenals, I find. One question that you can ask people is, how do you feel after exercise? When a person says, you know, I'm tired, but once I exercise, I just work through it, I feel great. A little less likely that they've got serious adrenal problems. But if they say, you know, I thought exercise would be a good idea, but then, you know, and I just put the pedal to the metal, I just collapse. I feel sick after exercise, just knocked out. It's just, I can't recover.
And so then that patient, I just encourage them to really take it slow. In fact, I might say don't start exercising until you start to feel better. And usually what I find is that the person will then report back to me within a few weeks or a couple months, depending on the severity of their condition. And they'll say to me, you know what, Dr. Wilson, now I feel like I could exercise. Can I start exercising? Then I know they're starting to be ready. And even then, I have them start slowly with even 5 or 10 minutes and tell them to stop if they feel lightheaded or weak in any way, because, or if they exercise and then they feel tired the next day, they know they overdid it.
Indeed. Yeah, they have to kind of feel their way through it and be very self-aware. People with adrenal problems have a peculiar relationship to salt and sodium. You know, there are most people these days, health-oriented people, are aware that salt is bad for you. They're on very low-sodium diets. But when you have low adrenals, the rules may change, right?
Oh, it's a really good point. You know, that actually the ratio of sodium-potassium can shift. That's another, sometimes we can see that in the blood work. See, otherwise, in standard blood work, we really can't identify the issue you and I are talking about. It doesn't show. I mean, sometimes you can see it in a sodium-potassium ratio, but not always. And yes, the body is less able to regulate the sodium levels, and so a person with low adrenal function may actually need a little extra sea salt just to help them improve.
Yeah, they might be feeling weak and woozy with very low blood pressure, you know, finding that they're vertiginous when they stand up, and that may be because they have low blood volume. And one of the ways to increase blood volume, make sure you drink, but not just, you know, distilled water, but, with, you know, get some electrolytes.
Definitely. Those electrolytes can really make a difference. Absolutely.
Okay. So one of the things that is featured in your book is, appropriately named, because you're out there on Long Island at one of your locations, the Hamptons Cleanse. Sounds good. What is that?
Yes, well, the Hamptons Cleanse is really a lot about what you and I've just been talking about. It's putting it in a form that I'm hoping makes it easy for people to make these lifestyle changes that we're discussing, to be feeding ourselves something healthy with not just carbs but proteins and healthy fats every 3 to 4 hours, and to be getting enough rest, and to avoid the foods in the diet that tend to stress the body as well. That's one thing we haven't talked about as much, but there's certain foods like gluten, for example, or any other food sensitivities that can only aggravate inflammation and cortisol levels. And
well, that's an interesting point, because a lot of people look at stress as, well, it's something external, you know, like my boss yelled at me, I don't get along with my wife, my kids are aggravating me. But actually, you can have internal stress, because if you constantly are eating the wrong foods, that does create stress within your body, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. And so when we, and those are stresses we can do something about. A lot of times, you know, we can't change sometimes our family or our work, but what you can change is the food you're eating every day. And so when we bring it back to that, we can go, okay, here's something that I have control over, I can make a choice about, and I can choose to avoid the foods that may be causing stress in my body. The most common, I would say, are gluten and dairy products. And so the Hamptons Cleanse helps a person to avoid those foods in their diet.
And what is that? Is it a product, or is it a process that they undergo at your clinics?
It's well, both. I mean, there's the idea of the Hamptons Cleanse is to support a person with these diet changes and lifestyle changes. There is a shake, which is a Hamptons Cleanse protein shake, which is an organic pea protein based shake. So this is, it gives a person something to choose to eat at least 1 to 3 times a day, and they know it's going to be dairy and gluten-free, as well as healing to the body, so they can choose that during the Hamptons Cleanse if they like. And the cleanse is meant to be about 21 days, but the idea is that the person gets to experience for 21 days, what is this like when I choose differently and I follow the E7 principles of the Hamptons Cleanse? Now how do I feel, and what do I want to continue to choose?
It's a teachable moment, because until you've experienced it, it's really hard to intellectualize it. You have to kind of make your body a living laboratory. And once you experience the absence of food stressors and you stabilize your blood sugar, you can think clearly, you have more energy, and you know, that makes people want to adhere to it.
And now they've given a chance for their adrenals to do some recovery and see how they feel. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. Well, that, I think that's an important element of any stress remedy, is not just to work on psychological factors, mm-hmm. as we are often encouraged to do. On a different subject, you are a certified midwife. And in fact, I just learned that you recertified as a midwife, which is a big deal, because it's being a midwife is, you know, it's an ancient practice. But these days, you've got to really verse yourself in high tech obstetrics in order to preside over a birth. So congratulations to you. You can now do it. But this is not something you do on a daily basis. People aren't going to be able to show up at your clinic and say, my water broke, and Dr. Donnie, can you deliver my baby? That's not happening. But at least this is something that you have experience in. So this is making a big comeback in America, isn't it, natural childbirth?
It is, and I think it's, you know, this is why I choose to recertify, is because I so much want to my passion for natural childbirth. I'm very committed to all the options that it gives to women, and also to know that midwives don't just do childbirth. Midwives are also trained to do well woman care. So, you know, if you're a woman and you're looking for a practitioner who can support you even if you're not pregnant, midwives are also an option for that. And it's an important part of our medical community.
And why is it, what is the element that's missing from modern obstetric care that the midwife fulfills?
You know, it's a good question. I would say that, you know, because I certainly don't want to say anything negative about, you know, OBGYNs, which I think, you know, everyone is wonderful and has, you know, great things to offer and is obviously very important, especially in high-risk births. But I would suppose in more low-risk births, and for women who would prefer to have an experience where they, you know, especially if everything is going well and they're healthy, they may not need the kinds of interventions that are available when they are necessary. You know, a midwife does make that possible for a woman to have a more natural, less invasive birth experience.
And what about home births? You know, home births, it sounds, you know, kind of risky, because the birth experience, I mean, there can be complications, there can be problems. But then again, hospitals tend to be unsafe places. There are a lot of germs in hospitals. They're very clamorous. The environment is very sterile. This is a natural process that's been happening for millennia. And only recently have we converted it into a high-tech medical experience. So what about home births? Is that something you encourage?
I had my daughter at home. Now it's been 11 years ago. And most of my experience was as a midwife was working in home births and birth centers. So I have a lot of trust and confidence in births in those environments. And, you know, again, especially, you know, to be able to offer those experiences for women who are healthy and have a low-risk pregnancy, I think it's really important. You know, certainly we also know that there's, in hospitals, there's going to be a much higher rate of intervention in birth that, you know, sometimes more so than you know, really is needed. If it, you know, you're much more likely to have an intervention if you're already in the hospital. So,
and what we mean by intervention is C-section, and C-section mm-hmm. rates are skyrocketing in America and across the Western world, but particularly in America. And in fact, I think it's 1/3 C-sections now, which is really a change in from practice. Even a few decades ago. And yes, C-sections are great, and sometimes they're life-saving and they're necessary. On the other hand, if there's a little bit of checks and balances against doing it too precipitously, there are tremendous advantages if your baby has had the old-fashioned way, right? Or what are some of those advantages?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, you know, working with a midwife as well as a doula, I would definitely also like to add that doulas are such an important part of prenatal and labor care, because research has shown that having a doula at a birth really helps with the not only the progress of labor, but making it so that there's, you know, no unnecessary interventions, you know, that this things move along more efficiently. And, you know, I think that's it, is if you can, you know, certainly if you need a C-section, it's absolutely something you want to be able to have. But there are ways that having someone who, you know, has experience with supporting in labor, we know from the research that helps to decrease the rate of intervention or C-section.
And a quick definition of doula, and it's spelled D-O-U-L-A. You know, unfortunately, in this country, we have to remind people of what a doula is. It's a, you know, an integral part of the birth process in the vast majority of cultures around the world.
It's a labor support person. A doula is not so much trained in the medical side. They're not going to be, you know, helping with the actual delivery of the newborn. They're there to support the woman in labor emotionally and help with just the pain of labor. So in understanding the process of labor. And, you know, we can all imagine, right? In fact, I often think that the concept of doula can be transferred to a lot of processes in life, right? No matter what process we're going through that's stressful, right? If we had a doula there to help us talk through what is the process, you know, we know from research that the more people get to talk about their stress and be supported by another person when they're under stress, then it helps the person so much. They're going to be much more healthy when they have that kind of support. So a doula is specifically someone who's trained to support women in labor.
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, you sound, you know, of course, I've met you in person, but you sound great and very approachable. And I think that that's what makes it possible for you to see a lot of clients in the tri-state area. What's the call to action? Your book, The Stress Remedy, is available, and it's a great primer on dealing with stress, understanding stress. But also, you have written a lot of blogs, there are a lot of articles, there's some videos at your website, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the book you can find at thestressremedy.com. My website
beststressremedy.com.
Yeah, the stress remedy.
Oh, thestressremedy.com. Okay, great.
It's also available at Amazon and you know, iBooks and so on, if you prefer it in that format. And then my website where you were mentioning I have the blog, it's called empoweringwellness.com. empoweringwellnessnaturally.com.
Or drdonnie.com.
Or drdonnie.com.
And which is spelled D-O-N-I, D-O-N-I.
Yes, oh, thank you, yes, drdonnie.com. I do have a quiz up on the website there, too, if you want a quick view at how stress may be affecting your health.
Oh, great. So take the stress quiz at Dr. Donnie. Doctor is spelled out, D-O-N-I.com.
Yes. And I'm excited because I'm going to be doing a book signing in Manhattan next week on the March 21st.
Oh, great.
So
how appropriate. Whereabouts?
That's going to be at Whole Foods on and Bowery, the Houston Street Whole Foods.
Oh, cool.
On the 21st at 7. Yes, yeah, so if anyone would like to come meet me in person, and they're going to actually, in the book, there's about 50 pages of recipes, so Whole Foods is going to be using one of the recipes from the book for the book signing, so that's exciting, too.
And that's on the first day of spring, to commemorate the first day of spring, March 21st, did you say?
Yes.
Great. Well, let's hope that it's above 35 degrees on the first day of spring this year, because it doesn't look good so far. Dr. Donnie also has a last name. It's Dr. Donnie Wilson, but we prefer to, and her patients prefer to call her Dr. Donnie. And on the cover of her book, there's a beautiful picture of Dr. Donnie with her daughter, which was born via home birth and presumably through traditional methods. And she turned out great. She's a beautiful girl.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for joining us and informing our audience about the important subject of stress and adrenal function. And that's what you find in the book, The Stress Remedy, Dr. Donnie Wilson. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.